Welcome to another Buzz Marketing for Technology podcast. I'm your host, Paul Dunay, publisher of the blog, and today I'm speaking with Sean O'Driscoll, General Manager of Communities for Microsoft. So, Sean, the ability to go to market in the way that Don is talking about is something that I know you're working on and you're talking about with your communities. I mean, do you want to elaborate on that a little bit?
The whole concept of Wikonomics is the idea of massive collaboration and how you tap into the creative expertise and knowledge of people around the world. So one of the core principles about the book that I really identify with is that there will always be more experts on any given topic outside your company than you can possibly marshal inside your company, which is, you know, true no matter how big you are, right? Microsoft's a company of 70,000 people. So on the surface, we have a lot of resources. But that is trivial in comparison to the 500 million installed PC users around the world who have interest in PC software and PC technology. So the issue is, how do you actually start to marshal all that knowledge and expertise around topics? And, you know, the open source world provided a good lesson for all of us in how you tap into people interested in a topic and get them sharing and developing technology that others would be useful, think was useful. For us, you know, we see similar things in a lot of our online and still existing offline communities, whether it's in the news groups or blogs or forums, where you literally have millions of people asking help and how-to questions. And like most communities, you have this amazingly active core group of answerers who have made a tremendous hobby out of helping people be successful with nothing more than sort of the pay-it-forward model in mind, right, is you know, if I did you a favor, and instead of you doing me a favor back, you went and did a favor for three others, you know, and that continued for 2 weeks, that's 5 million people that get touched,
right,
via that sort of pay-it-forward sort of model. And I think sometimes people confuse the two movie metaphors of communities, between the movie Pay It Forward and the movie Field of Dreams. And if you build it, they will come, tends to not be the story of success for really creating vital and engaged communities. You need to build a model where pay it forward is the ROI for the participant.
Mm. So, I mean, how do you build the community? That's one of the things I was trying to get at with Mukund as well, was, you know, what are the initial steps, and what steps do you go through to either analyze or, you know, decide that this would be a fertile ground for you to build a community space in?
Well, it's a good question. I guess I wish I knew the secret sauce, too. And you know, at Microsoft, I think we've been lucky that a lot of communities already existed, and it has sort of brought me to a conclusion that I think the starting point for a discussion about community creation is to acknowledge that your community probably already exists. It may not exist online, or it may not exist in you know, really discoverable way, or it may not exist as hosted from your company or organization's web properties. But your community already does exist for whatever it is that you're trying to facilitate. And if that community doesn't already exist, then starting community is probably not going to be successful, right? You probably have some other more fundamental problem to address, like customer interest or apathy for the topic or whatever it happens to be. So I like to start with the assumption that the community already exists. It's just a matter of how do you think about creating the venue where they want to participate. The problem with most web pages today, you know, I'll pick on Microsoft, because I guess as a Microsoft guy, I can safely pick on us and I won't get in trouble versus picking on other companies' stuff, and maybe I'll get in trouble for that. But the problem with most websites in the world today is I already know what they all say without ever going, right? If I'm going to buy a camera, I don't need to go to Nikon's site to know what it says. It says it's a good camera and it's easy to use and it's low cost of ownership and they have great support. Or if I go to Microsoft web pages, most of them, I kind of already know what they say. They kind of have the same value prop statements that every company has about their products and technologies. What I don't know is what other users are saying about the products.
Mm.
And so I like this starting point that says, hey, any web page, and it's a slight exaggeration to be fair, but I think any web page that doesn't host user-to-user conversation is approaching a point of futility. Right? Why would I go there? I already know what it says. What's interesting to me is the surprises on pages that have user-to-user conversation. So the goal, in our case, for a support site, you know, support sites are a classic example. If I'm a user, my goal, the second I get to an online support web page, is how quickly can I leave? right? How quickly can I find the answer and go?
Right.
And that's not what we as a company should want or any other company should want for a support page. It's how do you create an environment where people want to stay and share their knowledge and expertise and creativity with others about how they've used that technology to solve problems for them. And so for us, that started with, and I guess that's what I would say to anybody is, if I was picking a place to start, I would start with forums. It's question and answer forums. At least that's what we did, and I think that was a good place for us to begin. And then step two, I think, is very clearly identify who those most active answerers are in those forums and really go deeply engage with them. You owe them a debt of thanks, but you should go engage really deeply with them.
Right, give them the tools that they need in order to engage further and have a richer dialogue with the folks who are coming.
Yeah, and give them access to you in ways that will help develop their sense of contribution back to you. So, for example, for us, that might be around product feedback. I like the analogy of creating maternity or paternity for your users. At the point in time, they feel like they've given birth to something you sell because they really believe you've taken and ingrained their feedback in either your products or your content. Then you've created something pretty special because I blogged this recently on my site is, you know, we've all seen ugly babies, but none of us have ever had one.
Okay.
And so it's the same is true of some of our own ideas, right? Is we all love to evangelize our ideas. That's the nature of things. And so when somebody feels like they've contributed to your product or contributed to your content or contributed to your idea, they feel ownership for that idea. And they'll look past the faults much more readily than the average user will.
Uh-huh.
And that could be as true for Microsoft as it is true for open source software where people don't see all the faults because they gave birth to it. It's true for many different subjects.
Okay, but I want to back you up because there was a really beautiful point in there, which was I said to you, give them tools, and you said to me, no, don't give them tools. Give them access to more content, richer content, access to the senior leaders in your organization, so that they have new interesting material to bring back to the group and therefore become more engaged with it in order to get to that sort of paternal, maternal state that you were talking about.
That's right. I mean, I think a lot of the, I'll call it the recognition programs out there that different companies utilize in their community development are all about points and avatars, right? It's, you accumulate points, and those points get exchanged for an avatar or some higher status on the site. And I guess there's nothing wrong with that sort of reputation model.
Right.
And you know, some of them are probably more engaging than others, and certainly they do expose a currency around ego and status, which isn't a bad thing to investigate. But in the end, I think what has made our community successful is that commitment to a real bi-directional relationship between the people that actually build our products and the product teams and the people who are contributing to the communities focused on those products. And you create private conversations between the product experts and the community enthusiasts in ways that actually builds trust and shares knowledge between them that helps you achieve that goal I outlined, which is we build better products, and they provide more answers to users, and everybody feels like that's a good solution.
Right, and it gives you all of the attributes of things that you'd want downstream about, you know, they're a responsive company, they're listening to us, they're engaging with us in a manner that's consistent with the way that we want to be engaged with. I mean, all of the natural effects of, you know, what people who are looking at Web 2.0 tools and trying to figure out how do I engage with my customers, how do I do all these things, you know, it's already built into the model that you just laid out.
Yeah, I mean, I think our communities have the potential to be the biggest listening system for our company that we've ever invested in.
Wow.
Now, it's not easy to harvest all that content in ways that you can organize it and make it useful to your company. But, I think it's an amazing opportunity to turn your websites and your support centers and your call centers and everything else you do into true customer listening systems that help direct your product innovation.
Right. Now, can you give us an idea how many sites, how many communities you're either working on or have built or have in your, you know, radar?
Well, we, you know, our community, I guess, portfolio, I'll use that word, includes literally thousands of communities. So one of the larger communities we have is around the news groups. So the news groups have been a very active source of help and how-to around Microsoft products since the early 90s. And today there are something over almost 3,000 news groups around Microsoft products. In fact, in the new release of Windows Vista, from two clicks in the desktop shell, you will be in Ask an Expert in the Vista news groups. So we've really integrated community directly into the product experience, which I think was a smart thing for us to do in terms of making our communities more accessible and discoverable to the millions of users that use the products. We also have some very large forums, so pure web forum-based properties off of MSDN for developers and off of TechNet for IT pros and Xbox for around the gaming community. But beyond that, there are literally thousands of third-party communities that Microsoft doesn't manage or directly control at all that have sprung up around our products and technologies, including local user groups, which I still consider part of community, even though they're offline.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way we really think about engaging all those third-party communities, because it's hard to get the analytics, is can we at least identify the most active answerers, right, the high-value contributors? And that's why we created this program we call the Most Valuable Professional Program, which is the brand we associate with the today about 4,000 most active technical contributors to Microsoft communities, whether they're news groups or forums or bloggers or local user group leaders. And how do we make sure that we're being super accountable to those 4,000 users in ways to connect them to product feedback and betas and local events and inviting them to Redmond? We had a summit here in Redmond in March. We invited all of them to Seattle to be a part of that event. And Bill Gates took time on stage and spent almost an hour doing just Q&A.
Wow.
With this audience. And, you know, talk about a really personal interaction where it's not you're going to a typical conference where it's PowerPoint after PowerPoint after PowerPoint. But this is almost, not quite an unconference, but almost to that nature of it's a discussion. It's a three-day discussion, not a three-day PowerPoint onslaught.
Right. Is there a formulaic pattern to this? Is there, you know, every quarter we do a conference or an unconference?
Yeah, we do. About once a year we do a big conference in Redmond that we call the MVP Global Summit.
Okay.
And we pick up their hotel costs and we feed them, but it's up to them to pay their own way to get here.
Mm-hmm.
Which in and of itself is pretty astounding, right? Is because these are individuals, not companies. And so the cost of travel is generally borne by them as a person, not by some organization they work for picking up their travel and entertainment expenses. This last year we had almost half of our attendees at this conference came from overseas. And some of them from markets where that airfare was probably a month's salary or more.
Ooh.
So the level of passion of this particular audience is pretty astounding in their interest in coming and being a part of something like this. And they come not because, you know, they're just Microsoft's fan club. In fact, many of them would sort of argue that, hey, we don't do this to help Microsoft. We do this to help users. We do it to help other people because we enjoy the fact that people say thanks in the community when we answer their question. And they do it. It certainly benefits Microsoft that they're doing this. But, you know, we would oftentimes say our MVPs are some of our biggest fans, but they're also often our harshest critics. They're the ones most likely to give us the deep, honest truth about the things that we've done poorly in our products. And in our corporate culture, those are the people we want to talk to face-to-face.
Right.
Because they'll tell us what we did wrong, they won't sugarcoat it, and they'll give us an opportunity to do it better. And that loops back to that issue of, you know, kind of creating paternity or maternity.
Right. You know, so often I hear from, you know, other folks in the field that, you know, they don't want to start the community because they're afraid of what they might hear.
Yeah.
You know, and it's sort of a catch-22 in that way. So I want to take a turn to a little bit of a different direction, which is, you know, if you've got all of these at your disposal, how did you use them with the rollout of Vista? Was there a way in which you rolled that into some sort of an integrated marketing plan to help the viral nature of Vista spread?
Yeah, I mean, we've done a couple of things, and I would sort of describe it as, once you know who your most active enthusiast core is in your communities, what you want to make sure you do is you provide them with opportunities to take action. And I use that word intentionally. You're not providing them with obligation, because there can be no obligation that's supporting community.
Mm-hmm.
But you provide them with opportunities. So as an example of that, one of the things that we did around the Vista launch is, obviously, when we launch a big product like that, there's lots of local events in your local CompUSA and Computer City and retail outlets all over the place. And so we created opportunities where these MVPs could go and be a part of that launch event as an expert in those local store markets. And, you know, guess who customers really like to talk to? The Microsoft guy or the MVP?
The MVP.
They like talking to the MVP, the real user, who talks like they do, who uses the product like they do, who will criticize Microsoft if there's something there that they don't like. And guess who we should like? The MVP. Mm. Because, frankly, people are more likely to make a buying decision from someone like that that they trust than the manufacturer employee who's, you know, frankly, always going to recommend our products. That's our job.
Right.
And it's not that we're being dishonest. It's just we're so close to it.
Gets you back to that comment you were making, you know, before we started the podcast around, you know, Amazon and the user reviews on Amazon.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I actually think what Amazon has done with community is quite good, and I like user reviews. I think if someone was going to buy a camera today, right, why would you go into a camera store at all, I guess would be the first question.
Mm-hmm.
And if you did, who would know more, you or the kid behind the counter? In today's world, you would likely know more, right, because you've already been online and you've done a ton of research about cameras, and a lot of that coming through user reviews. And you know, I'm not a camera guru. I don't know really what shutter speed means. I kind of conceptually get it, but I don't know what a good number is. If somebody put a number behind shutter speed, I wouldn't know if that was good or bad.
Right.
In context. What I do understand is that when another hobbyist user has posted in a user review, that when they click the button, they often miss the action because things have moved, because there's latency or something. I know what that means. That's shutter speed. Now they're describing what annoyed me about our first digital camera, is I missed a lot of action photos because digital cameras were, at the time, still a little slower than you know, traditional film-based cameras. And now they've, you know, with SLRs and things, they've gotten a lot faster. But at the time, that was very annoying. I also knew that I wanted a battery that I could replace anywhere, right? So there were some user requirements that I had that wouldn't necessarily show up in the specs the way I would understand them, but I often found explored in user reviews that actually were really validating and helped me decide what I wanted to buy. So I like that analogy as a simple way of saying, you know, corporations don't speak the way the average user wants to consume information, but our peer users do, and that's kind of why we want their voice as part of that decision-making process.
Sure. Simplistically, you know, companies speak you know, shutter speed and other data points around their product as if people would recognize that as being extremely valuable.
That's right.
And when the actual user can speak to the hard-won experience of, you know, what was it like and how did it feel, how did it make you feel when you were using the product, which is very, very, very different.
That's right.
Yeah. Interesting. So from a day-to-day perspective, you know, you're managing multiple communities. I know many of my readers are thinking about how do you start just one. So, you know, what does it feel like to have multiple communities underneath you, and what is your day-to-day like as far as dealing with different communities?
Yeah, and I imagine this is a little different in a lot of different segments. But for me, I kind of think of managing communities as almost an oxymoron. You know, I almost feel like I'm managed by the communities themselves, versus the other way around.
Excellent.
It's much like, herding cats, as the old, you know, there was a great commercial a few years ago that it was a funny little viral bit. of the Cowboys hurting the Cats. And it is a little bit like that. I mean, you know, the more effort you put in trying to control and manage your communities, it almost feels like an inverse relationship. And so I think what you want to try to do as a community manager is kind of create the boundaries with which you want that community to thrive and what the behaviors are going to look like, what good behavior is going to look like. And if you're going to invest in moderation, which is a good idea for most starting communities, you know, being consistent about what those policies are and how you enforce them, and then letting the community take its course and within those boundaries. And I think, you know, when you've gone wrong, when you delete a post, and that post was nothing but just a criticism about your company or your products, right? Is you should delete offensive material, but in most other respects, everything else is fair game. Hmm. Somebody wants to criticize you, your products, your policies, your company. It's better to see that than not see it. And so I think, you know, there's sort of somebody once, I was at an event, somebody in the community space said, hey, in Web 2.0 world, negative's the new positive.
Excellent.
And I kind of loved that.
Yeah.
And so I think that's one thing about managing those communities is sort of embracing that negative is kind of the new positive and let it go. And I should give her credit for that, and I'm blanking on the name at the moment, but it was the gal who runs the blogs at southwest.com for Southwest Airlines.
Oh, okay. I could see how that could be one of her statements.
Yeah.
Contiguous with that thought, I was reading about how Dig recently tried to stop community members from posting a 32-digit number used
yeah.
to decrypt Blu-ray and HD DVDs.
It's a great story.
Yeah. So how do you feel about that as a community manager? And I know they came out most recently saying, you know, we're not going to do that again.
Yeah, bad idea. Here's a story of an encryption key for HD and Blu-ray DVDs being leaked and propagating across the web. Now, at the time this story hit Big about 10 days ago.
Yeah.
This was kind of already old news, right? The leak had occurred over a month prior to this. And, you know, I had never seen the story in that occurring month. And then suddenly, a group of industry attorneys decided to sue and say, you know, basically try to put the cease and desist on the existence of this encryption key. And that story got put into Dig. And and some other stories were in Dig that included the encryption key, I guess. And Dig got a letter from the attorneys. This is my understanding of how this all went down. So I could have some of my facts wrong, but my understanding of how it all went down. And Dig sort of did the traditional corporate response as well. We better take action. Which I'm not sure they did the wrong thing, to be perfectly honest. You know. You do have to protect IP or you have other kinds of issues. The problem with what happened is it suddenly became a gigantic story because of the action they took to pull down these posts. And, of course, in the web world, with millions of users out there using Dig, everybody then reposted the story back to Dig and dug it like crazy, and it surfaced to the top, and this thing took on a life of its own. And so what I think was actually more interesting than Dig about this was the lesson to the corporate attorneys that actually chose to take that action.
Okay.
I'm not sure I want to judge the action that Dig took.
Okay.
I think they were put in a very tough situation. But I will judge the action of the attorneys and the corporations behind them that chose to pursue this, right? Because in my mind, at the time they decided to pursue this, the horse had already left the barn. Right, the encryption code was already out and proliferated across the web, so the damage was done. Right? And the sheer act of suing or reaching out with cease and desist created a story that was largely unknown to the masses.
Right. I mean, it got it to my desk, which that would be the acid test of that. It was an amplifier.
Exactly. So their reaction to the scenario, exactly, gets a great choice of words, sort of amplified something that was already over and done with and brought a whole bunch of bad PR and bad press to everybody involved. And it's sort of the story it reminded me of was a few months back when Turner Broadcasting did the thing in Boston around the Cartoon Network launch, right? And they put that box of wires and everybody thought it was a bomb scare and you know, a few days later, we find out that it was this promotional to advertise this new Cartoon Network show. And,
right.
And, you know, good, bad, or indifferent, what people think about that. What I enjoyed as a Web 2.0 guy, what I enjoyed about watching that was seeing what the response management from Turner Broadcasting was. So their response to this crisis became was a classic Web 1.0 response, which is formal corporate apology, one-page apology in the Boston Herald or whatever the local paper was, and, you know, shame on us, basically.
Right. Mea culpa.
Mea culpa, right? So that is the Web 1.0 apology. A few weeks later, we had the opportunity to see the Web 2.0 apology, which was JetBlue. So JetBlue had their disaster with the weather, and a bunch of things went wrong for them, and I didn't even follow the story super closely at the time. But then I saw a YouTube apology hosted on JetBlue's site from their CEO. This is the Web 2.0 apology, where the CEO stands up in front of a camera in what looks to be very unscripted and very sincere sounding, a personal apology for what had happened and why it would never happen again and how it hurt their company at the core, and, you know, all very personal message. And I love looking at those two apologies in this context of Web 1.0 response management versus Web 2.0 response management. Because now, in truth, I don't think either one of us knows whether Turner Broadcasting or JetBlue, which one was truly more apologetic for what happened. But I'll tell you which one I believed more.
Right.
That JetBlue one sounded awful sincere to me, and that other one seemed awfully scripted by attorneys.